Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 504, titled The Vatican Rag, Reflections on the Death of the Pope. This is being recorded on April 3rd of the year 2005. Veteran listeners to these broadcasts will recall the many, many programs that have been done over the years about the Vatican banking scandals, their intersection with the P2 crypto-fascist government that has wielded profound influence in Italy for many, many years. The heirs to that legacy are people like Silvio Berlusconi himself, a former member of the P2, now Prime Minister of Italy. One of the things that the P2 Lodge, headed up by former Mussolini advocate Licio Gelli, Gelli himself, not only an active Italian fascist, but also the liaison officer to the Hermann Göring Division during World War II, Licio Gelli was, again, a doctrinaire fascist and wielded control of the P2 Lodge, a corrupt Masonic lodge that wielded a profound influence not only in Italian society, but also in Latin America, where there were very, very significant branches in Argentina and Uruguay, and also here in the United States. Gelli was an honored guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration, and a fellow named Philip Guarino, who was part of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, the fascist wing of the Republican Party, was a member of the P2 Lodge. Pope John Paul II has passed away, obviously, as I'm speaking on April 3rd, and lost in the hagiographies that are being generated about the death of Pope John Paul II is the fact that Pope John Paul II was certainly an active collaborator with and a coverer up of the P2 mess, in particular how the ways in which it related to the Vatican banking scandals. But the available evidence suggests very strongly that the Pope's his tour of duty, so to speak, at Auschwitz was something more than a mere laborer. The evidence suggests that he was something of a labor capo, or was in some ways viewed with favor by his Nazi masters. His post-World War II history is one of association with fascism, both the Opus Dei Lay Vatican Order and later the P2 milieu. And as we're going to see, he brought in one of the top Nazi bankers to help straighten out the Vatican banking scandals. So, in light of the hagiographies that are being generated about Pope John Paul II, we're going to take a look at some of the hard realities, not only of his papacy, but how his papacy really fit into the deep politics of the 20th and now early 21st centuries. We're going to begin by taking a look at the evolution of the fascist-Vatican connection. And in particular, we're going to take a look at an American fascist named Hugh Angleton, who was very active in Italy. And we're going to take a look at Hugh Angleton's role in helping to introduce some of the people who were to figure very prominently in the Vatican banking scandals, the P2 mess, and ultimately the circumstances that appear to have brought Pope John Paul II to power and the circumstances that he helped to cover up. You will recall that the most recently deceased pope is called Pope John Paul II. He was named after Pope John Paul I, who lasted all of 28 days and then died under very strange circumstances. The available evidence suggests very, very strongly that Pope John Paul I was murdered. And the reason for that was that he was going to turn out the P2 Nexus Archbishop Paul Marcinkus and the people that had been brought in by his predecessor, Pope Paul VI, nay Giovanni Battista Montini, an individual who was active in helping to provide papers for many of the top Nazis to escape from Europe to Latin America and elsewhere after World War II. Unfortunately, John Paul I was not able to reform the Vatican. Indeed, his precipitous death after only 28 days in office was covered in RFA number 18, among other broadcasts. The evidence suggests very strongly that he was murdered. For background on this broadcast, I recommend emphatically RFA program 17 through 21, available from Spitfire. We're going to take a look at, again, how the Vatican banking scandals, the P2 Lodge, the Nazi flight from Europe after World War II, the Nazi diaspora, and the reconstruction of the Nazi financial apparatus after World War II overlap not only with the Vatican, but specifically the circumstances that surrounded John Paul II. We're going to begin by reading a passage from The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, and published in hardcover and softcover by the St. Martin's Press. The Hugh Angleton here is the father of James Jesus Angleton, for many years the CIA's counterintelligence chief, and Hugh Angleton was a doctrinaire fascist and an individual who bequeathed his legacy to the late James J. Angleton. Hugh Angleton's rise to power was in part an accident of geography. He lived in Milan for many years and made more than a few friends there before the war. It was Hugh Angleton who allegedly introduced Giovanni Battista Montini to Michele Sindona, a pre-war banker in Milan. Sindona was the corrupt financier who later became the advisor to the Vatican Bank. Montini, who was Vatican Undersecretary of State during the war, later became Pope Paul VI. Parenthetically, Sindona was a member of the P2, as was his successor, Roberto Calvi. Both died under very strange circumstances, and again, that's discussed in RFA program 17 through 21. Continuing. There is some circumstantial evidence that Hugh Angleton also introduced both of these friends to Alan Dulles. Both Sindona and Montini allegedly became sources for the CIA after the war, with Hugh's son, James Jesus Angleton, as their case handler. Several historians agree with our sources on this point, although, as we shall see, the Vatican has gone to considerable lengths to deny the allegations. One of James Jesus Angleton's enemies, of whom he had many, insists that his father served as a minor point of contact and occasional courier for secret financial transactions between the Vatican and Nazi Germany. That the Vatican encouraged such investments and even donated money to Hitler himself cannot be denied. A German nun, Sister Pascalina, was present at the creation. In the early 1920s, she was the housekeeper for the Archbishop of the Vatican Nazi connection, Eugenio Pacelli, then the Papal Nuncio in Munich. Sister Pascalina vividly recalls receiving Adolf Hitler late one night and watching the Archbishop give Hitler a large amount of money. Sister Pascalina had absolutely no motive to discredit Archbishop Pacelli. She was his greatest admirer and remained his faithful servant all her life, even after he became Pope Pius XII. Her story has the ring of truth, all the more powerful because it admits the worst blunder of Pacelli's career. It was Pacelli who later convinced the Vatican to invest millions of dollars in the rising German economy, money from the Vatican's land settlement with Mussolini that ended the Pope's claim of sovereignty over territory outside the walls of Vatican City. It was Pacelli who negotiated the Concordat with Hitler's Germany and then had to deal with the consequences of his own mistakes when he became Pope on the eve of World War II. So again, note that the Vatican Bank had invested a great deal of money in Nazi Germany, and it was then Archbishop Eugenio Pacelli who first began channeling Vatican money to the Nazis. He eventually was succeeded by Giovanni Battista Montini, who had helped to assist the flight of not only Nazi war criminals but Nazi capital after World War II. And in this regard, this milieu was working very closely with Alan Dulles, the advisor for the Nazi investments of the Bush family. Returning once again to the secret war against the Jews, the safe haven here refers to the attempts at interdicting the Nazi flight capital program, which was to birth the Bormann organization and the Underground Reich, about which I've spoken so often. Soon after the safe haven inquiry into his own Nazi money smuggling was buried, Alan Dulles resigned from the OSS, parenthetically America's World War II intelligence service, and returned to New York to do what he did best, move money illegally for his clients. One of the first names on his client list was a personal matter for Thomas McKittrick, the head of the previously Nazi-dominated Bank of International Settlements, or BIS, in Switzerland. The BIS had overseen the transfer of Nazi assets to Switzerland. After the war, the Nazis moved the money via the Vatican to Argentina. Dulles represented a staggering array of Argentine corporate and political entities before and after the war. President Juan Perón and his family were ardent Catholics and violently anti-communist, as were many Argentines. In fact, Perón was decidedly pro-fascist, and Argentina was the only South American country that continued relations with the Third Reich well into the war. The Argentine economy boomed with the massive post-war transfer of Nazi flight capital. Skipping down. The old spies say that Dulles did not have to try very hard to convince Donovan that President Truman was an idiot and that the only hope of the revival of an American intelligence service was to end the Democratic Party's stranglehold on the White House in the 1948 election. In the meantime, Dulles and Donovan agreed that every effort must be made to sabotage the Truman liberals and quietly prepare for the Cold War. To this end, Dulles convinced Donovan to serve on the board of a company that would help rebuild the German economy as a bulwark against communism. Dulles assured his old boss that there were a large number of wealthy South American investors, especially in Argentina, who were willing to help rebuild Germany. Although Donovan did not know it, Dulles had conned him into serving as the front man for the Nazi money launderers. He and Sir William Stevenson from British Intelligence joined the board of directors of the World Commerce Corporation, with Alan Dulles naturally as their lawyer. The Nazi money flowed in a great circle, out of the Third Reich, through the Vatican, to Argentina, and back to, quote, democratic, unquote, West Germany. The source of the miraculous West German economic revival in the 1950s was the same money that had been stolen in the 1940s. One of our sources, Daniel Harkin, stumbled across part of the money laundering in 1945. Harkins had volunteered to work as a double agent for naval intelligence before World War II. He posed as a Nazi ringleader in Detroit and even had his picture published in a newspaper giving the Nazi salute. He was promptly invited to Berlin to meet the leading members of Hitler's cabinet. Hitler didn't know it, but Harkin's work helped close down the Nazi Bund operation in the United States. After wartime service as a naval officer, Harkins was posted to the Allied occupation government in Germany. Although he was genuinely anti-Nazi, Harkins loved and respected the German people who had to survive in the ashes of the bombed-out Third Reich. To Harkins' horror, his German sources revealed that the big Nazis had gotten their money out before the war was over. Through Switzerland, the SS had purchased stock in American corporations and laundered their money through the unknowing Chase and the Korn Exchange Bank. Parenthetically, your veteran listeners will, of course, recognize the Bormann Organization as the organization that grew out of this Nazi money smuggling. A couple of the major elements of its power in contemporary America are not only the huge blocks of stock it holds in American corporations, but also the German core corporation's ability to influence policy through the allocation of advertising money and the media. Yep, those are two major sources of power. Continuing, even worse, the W.R. Grace Corporation was using its Pan Am Clippers to fly Nazi gems, currency, and bonds to South America. Harkins had discovered a small part of the Dulles money laundering machine conducted in combination with the Vatican. Before he could find out any more, however, he was suddenly transferred to the State Department where the Dulles clique could keep an eye on him. To his surprise, he was then reassigned to the outposts of Southeast Asia. More about this connection, by the way, in the World Commerce Corporation, the front that was used to move this money, in addition to William Donovan and Sir William Stevenson and Alan Dulles, there was also a guy named Edward Stettinius, who was a key partner in the Morgan Financial and Industrial Nexus. We're going to turn now, for more about this discussion, to yet another book by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, the preceding volume to The Secret War Against the Jews. This is called Unholy Trinity, The Vatican, the Nazis, and the Swiss Banks. And in that we read, State Department records for South America confirmed that the Croatian Ustashi Minister for Finance and the French Undersecretary of State for the Vichy government went to Argentina via the Vatican rat line. By the way, that was a conduit to help Nazi collaborators and fascist war criminals escape from Europe to Latin America. Continuing, according to Paul Manning, there were rumors of others. He cites the FBI's copy of a surveillance file forwarded by the Central de Inteligencia of Argentina's Ministry of the Interior. In 1948, Martin Bormann received the bulk of the treasure that had made up the financial reserve of the Deutsche Bank. Like other fugitives, he entered Argentina in 1948, coming from Genoa on a second-class ticket with forged Vatican documentation. Skipping down. In 1945, the U.S. Treasury Department accused Alan Dulles of laundering funds from the Nazi Bank of Hungary into Switzerland. Similar charges were made against Dulles' agent, Hans Bernd Gassibius, who had worked for Dulles as an OSS agent while serving at the Reichsbank. By the way, parenthetically, Gasibius was also a Gestapo agent, and as we saw in For the Record 445, a collaborator in the post-war period with, among others, Prescott Bush Sr., the grandfather of the current seated president of the United States. Continuing. The State Department quickly took over the Treasury Department's money laundering allegations, and the Dulles Gasibius investigation was quietly dropped. Gasibius may have had some involvement with the Ratlines. He was a senior member of the Black Orchestra during World War II and was considered to be Alan Dulles' pipeline to Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, the Nazi chief of military intelligence. After the war, Gasibius personally briefed the Australian government on American efforts to resettle the surplus population of Europe and other countries, citing the support of the Committee for a Free Europe, later acknowledged as a clandestine front for Dulles' Cold War programs. This was also the organization which served as the American end of the Vatican Ratlines. The most important front group was an entity called the World Commerce Corporation, established after World War II to rebuild German-South American trade networks. The directors of this corporation were Sir William Stevenson, formerly of British Intelligence, and General William Donovan, formerly of the OSS. One of the attorneys for World Commerce was Alan Dulles, whose assistant Frank Wisner was the State Department's deputy for currency and economic reform in the American zone of West Germany. Many of the staff members for the economic reconstruction of occupied Germany came from the same international financial firms which had invested heavily in the pre-war German economy. By the way, Edward Stettinius, as I mentioned, was a Morgan partner, while Bill Donovan, head of the OSS, was also very close to the Morgan Group. Continuing, according to sworn testimony before the U.S. Senate by a representative of the German banking industry, an organization did exist in 1950 which was formed by Lord Shawcross of England and Mr. Hermann Abs of Germany to bring about a Magna Carta for the protection of foreign investments of World War II. This is the same Lord Shawcross who led the recent campaign in the British House of Lords to prevent reopening of war crimes investigations in Britain. Despite allegations by Paul Manning, it's difficult to believe that Shawcross would have lent his good name to Abs organization if he had known its real purpose. In a 1966 hearing before the Select Committee on Standards and Conduct of the U.S. Senate, Abs was identified as the common denominator of a group seeking return of vested enemy properties of World War II. When the United States entered the war in 1941, all of the branches of American banks in France under German control were closed except two which had ties to Abs, Morgan AC and Chase of New York. Both received this special treatment through the intercession of Dr. Hermann Josef Abs of Deutsche Bank, financial advisor to the German government. According to U.S. Treasury agent reports, the favorable treatment was due to an old-school tie, an unspoken understanding among international bankers that wars may come and may go, but the flux of wealth goes on forever. According to Nuremberg records, Abs Deutsche Bank was the principal conduit for laundering Nazi money into Argentina during the war under the supervision of Martin Bormann. The American war crimes investigation of Abs, former head of the Deutsche Bank, was quietly dropped, and Abs was appointed economic advisor for the British zone of Germany. It should also be noted that Abs became a financial advisor to the Vatican. Parenthetically, as we noted in RFAs 17-21, after the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano and the exposure of the Vatican banking scandals, Pope John Paul II brought in Hermann Abs to help straighten out the Vatican mess. And again, theoretically, Pope John Paul II was supposed to have been a slave laborer at Auschwitz. It was Hermann Abs who helped to capitalize the work camps at Auschwitz, and which shed serious doubt that Pope John Paul II was a slave laborer, would suggest rather that he was a privileged minor functionary. Continuing, according to Penny Lernoux, the financial collapse of Vatican-supported banks during the 1970s involved the same group of people connected to Dulles's and Angleton's network of money launderers. Prior to World War II, Angleton's father had financial interests in Milan and may have met both Montini and a Sicilian banker named Michele Sindona at this earlier time. According to Lernoux, Sindona wangled an introduction to the powerful Giovanni Montini in Milan, who would later become Pope Paul VI. Montini introduced Sindona to the leader of the Christian Democrats. Sindona served the younger Angleton for many years as a CIA funnel for supporting funds, unquote, to friendly Italian politicians. In 1969, Sindona became the financial advisor to the Vatican while Montini was the Pope. Sindona and his cohort Roberto Calvi created a financial scandal that cost the Vatican Bank hundreds of millions of dollars. And again, this is what Pope John Paul I was working to clean up. And as we looked at in RFA Program 18, available from Spitfire, the evidence suggests very strongly that JP1 was murdered and that somebody who could be trusted to keep the secrets, so to keep the lid on this boiling pot of banking scandal, John Paul II, nay Carol Whitelaw, was brought in to straighten out the mess. One of the most interesting assignations, as we near the end of this side, of Pope John Paul II was his association with a Polish Jewish doctor named Wolf Schmunes, last name S-Z-M-U-N-E-S-S. In RFA 16 and other programs, including For the Record 16, which is online, we talked about Wolf Schmunes, who has a very, very curious resume. Wolf Schmunes developed the experimental hepatitis B vaccine, which appears to have been the vehicle for spreading AIDS. As we've looked at in some of our work on AIDS, the epidemiology makes no sense. The earliest manifestations of AIDS, disclaimers to the contrary notwithstanding, were among gay Americans in three cities, San Francisco, L.A., and New York, and also the Denali Indians of the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska. And those groups of people have nothing in common. They ain't having sex and they ain't sharing needles, but they all received the experimental hepatitis B vaccine. And as we've looked at in connection with AIDS, only purebred Northern Europeans have a genetic immunity to this disease. It is the Aryan virus. And Wolf Schmunes appears to have been the individual who helped to develop the vaccine through which it was distributed. Turning now to a book, AIDS and the Doctors of Death, authored by Dr. Alan Cantwell and published in hardcover by the Aries Rising Press, copyright 88, we read, Schmunes, a Jew born in Poland in 1919, was a young medical student in Lublin in eastern Poland when the Nazis attacked that country in the summer of 1939. When Poland was quickly partitioned by Germany and Russia, Schmunes was sent to Siberia as a prisoner. His family in western Poland were all murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. Schmunes' years in exile in Siberia were a long, dark period that he was most reluctant to talk about, unquote. After release from detention in 1946, he was somehow allowed to finish his medical education in Tomsk in central Russia. While a student, he married a Russian woman. She specialized in epidemiology, and when his wife contracted a nearly fatal case of hepatitis, Schmunes decided that the study of the disease would be his life's work. In 1959, the Soviets allowed him and his family to return to Poland, where he held a series of minor positions as an epidemiologist in municipal and regional health departments, unquote. During this time, he told Kellner an interesting story. Due to exhaustion and stress from work, he applied to the authorities for a vacation at a rest home. Schmunes was allowed to share a room with a Catholic priest. A remarkable friendship developed, and the two men corresponded for a long time thereafter, unquote. The Polish priest eventually became the first Polish pope in Catholic history, the current anti-communist and anti-gay Pope John Paul II. In 1969, in another strange twist of fate, the communists allowed Schmunes and his wife and daughter to attend a scientific meeting in Italy. While there, he and his family defected to the West. He arrived in Manhattan with $15 in his pocket. Through the intervention of Walsh McDermott, a professor of public health at New York Hospital, Cornell Medical Center, Schmunes miraculously secured a position as a lab tech at the New York City Blood Center. Within a few years, Schmunes was given his own lab, and a separate department of epidemiology at the center was created for him. In what must be record time, he was leapfrogged to full professorship at the Columbia School of Public Health, unquote. By the mid-1970s, he was a world authority on hepatitis and transfusion medicine. In another unbelievable occurrence, he was invited back to Moscow in 1975 to give a scientific presentation. As a defector, he was terrified to set foot in the Soviet Union, but his colleagues assured him he would have the full protection of the State Department. He finally agreed to go, and his return to Russia was a scientific triumph. By the late 1970s, he'd been awarded millions of dollars in grant money and was phenomenally successful, unquote, in his hepatitis work, which had tremendous global implications, unquote. Schmunes' meteoric and unprecedented rise to world prominence was halted by his death from cancer in 1982. A 1983 paper published after his death detailed a new experimental hepatitis B vaccine program in Kangwane that would use black South African infants as experimental subjects. As a defector, could Shmunis have been a Russian agent? Or could he have been playing both sides of the field by working as a double agent for America and the Soviet Union? His life story was proof that he was honored by both countries. Although the scientific world would undoubtedly laugh at these questions, Shmunis's professional life in the communist and the free world was filled with the oddest of circumstances and coincidences. As a precaution against escape, it's my understanding that potential defectors from communist country are never allowed the opportunity to travel outside the country with their entire family. Yet Shmunis defected with his family in tow. After defecting, how was it possible to arrange his safe return to Russia to present a scientific paper? Undoubtedly, cooperation at the highest levels of both governments was necessary to accomplish this feat. And again, his long association with Carol Wojtyla, to whom he was very close, is very interesting. Again, the same Carol Wojtyla who brought in the very people who brought in Hermann Abs to help straighten out the Vatican banking scandals. The same Carol Wojtyla who, as noted, is very anti-gay as well as was very anti-gay as well as very as anti-communist. And the same Carol Wojtyla who succeeded John Paul I after John Paul I was in all probability murdered for moving to reveal the long tangle of Vatican fascist financial connections. Again, with regard to AIDS, note the strange epidemiology. Note also the following, and we're going to conclude with this element. This is from the book A Higher Form of Killing by Robert Harris and Jeremy Paxman, softcover Hill and Wang, 1982. And it said specifically, speaking of the application of genetic engineering to biological warfare, the implications were made more specific 7 years later when a Department of Defense spokesman claimed that genetic engineering could solve one of the major disadvantages of biological warfare, that it's limited to diseases which occur naturally somewhere in the world. Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism which could differ in certain important respects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. Basically, what you're seeing here is virtually the clinical definition of AIDS, except from a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing for the defense budget for 69-70, and just such a disease did appear in this time frame. Again, this is 1969, and it appeared within the next 5 to 10 years. The possibility that such a, the authors go on to comment, the possibility that such a super germ may have been successfully produced in a laboratory somewhere in the world in the years since that assessment was made is one which should not be too readily cast aside. And by the way, this book was republished in 2002, and that passage I just read you was left out. So again, among the many possible elements of legacy of Pope John Paul II concerns his association with Wolf Shmunis. And again, the evidence, I think, suggests very strongly that not only was AIDS created, but that it's the Aryan virus. It is a vehicle for extermination. It's also very ironic that the Pope is so anti-gay. In the mid-80s, when the AIDS epidemic was gathering steam, it was revealed that Catholic priests were among the high-risk groups for AIDS. One thing that has happened in the wake of John Paul II's death, there's a lot of criticism of him in places like Boston for failing to address the molestation scandals that have emerged in the Catholic Church. So again, as we assess the legacy of John Paul II, note the circumstances surrounding his ascension after the precipitous death and probable murder of his predecessor, who was going to end some of these Vatican banking connections and their long history of association with fascism. And note also the fact that he brought these same elements back to straighten out the Vatican Bank, including Hermann Abs in the early 80s. Note his association with Wolf Shmunis, and note that just such a disease, just such an organism predicted in the 1969 House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing appeared in that time. This concludes For the Record program number 504, The Vatican Rag, being recorded on April 3rd of 2005. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.